Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to be very focused on constitutional compliance. The whole point of being able to get this republic back into our hands, we the people, has nothing to do with Republican, has nothing to do with party, has nothing to do with government doing things for us. It has everything to do with holding our public servants accountable. Those elected officials who raise their arm to the square and swear that they are going to uphold and support the constitutions. If it's a state or a county, then the constitutions. At federal, it is the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, we have to hold them accountable. Accountability is the order of all things. If we have zero accountability, we have chaos. We have everybody doing and working political agendas and so forth. What we need is we need our liberty restored. And as long as we're willing to surrender them to our government to be able to do and rule us with powers they don't have, we're going to rue the day, folks. We're running out of time. It's now or never. In addition to that appeal to the great sovereign of all, of the sovereign of the universe, we need to continue learning. Reasonable people equally inform, seldom disagree. And as a matter of fact, one of the things I constantly see in different cultures and so forth, people that are very well informed, that are equally informed with other cultures and so forth, they come to the same conclusions. Now, they may not know Christ. They may not know, you know, certain things. But when they stumble upon these things, they start recognizing, well, wow, we see things the same way. The question is, how is it that some people become informed one very specific way and they turn their back on the truth and cling to the lies, the deceit, and the destruction? Because those are they who are seeking their rewards in this life. Those are they who choose to serve mammon. Those are they who choose to serve unrighteous causes and so forth. So anyway, let me just keep moving forward. If you're going to actually change the system, we have to hold people accountable. One of the things that we need to hold accountable is the Electoral College. We the people should be electing our electors. So this is one of the reasons why I'm kind of putting this front out of running for president. I'm happy to actually put it out there that I am seeking the Electoral College and members of the Electoral College to actually follow my campaign and to support electing a constitutional president. Forget about the party. Forget about the agendas. Forget about what we understand as politics. In America, politics is completely constrained by our constitutions. What that means is that we don't have politicians don't have the latitude to compromise on things that have not been granted. In other words, they can't compromise whether we're going to have health care or not. They can't compromise on a social security system. They can't compromise on all these different things. The only thing that they can compromise are those things that are delegated. How are they going to make a uniform rule of naturalization and or uniform rules and laws on bankruptcy? Or to establish patents for a very limited time? Or copyrights, those types of things? Or to whether they are going to decide to go one way as a standard for the militia or not? I mean, they're obligated to establish the standards and so forth and going down the path of ensuring that the state has the funding and everything it needs to be able to defend itself, as well as when necessary to basically adjoin or federalize some of the militias to actually defend, you know, from an invasion, to suppress an insurrection, and or to actually execute the laws of the Union. Anyway, so we're in the, let me see here, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, or something like that. Anyway, I don't say I'm fluent in Spanish, nor even imagine that I am. Anyway, we left off with Article 14, and now we're on Article 15. And so let me dive into this, because if we get this done today, then I'll be able to actually dive into the Utah Enabling Act. That is the last document, of as far as official documents, because as we look at documents generated by the federal government in the context of these state national sovereign citizens and these secessionists that basically think that everything our government does is legitimate. We've got to be smarter than that. We actually have to start challenging what our government is doing. But anyway, Article 15, the United States exonerating Mexico from all demands on account of the claims of their citizens mentioned in the preceding article, and considering them entirely and forever canceled, whatever their amount may be, undertake to make satisfaction for the same to the amount not exceeding $3.25 million. To ascertain the validity and the amount of those claims, a board of commissioners shall be established by the government of the United States, whose award shall be final and conclusive, provided that in deciding upon the validity of each claim, the BOA shall be guided and governed by the principles and rules of decision prescribed in the first and fifth articles of the unratified convention, concluded at the city of Mexico on the 20th day of November, 1843, and in no case shall an award be made in favor of any claim not embraced by these principles and rules. If the opinion of the said board of commissioners or the claimants, any books, records, or documents in the possession or power of the government of the Mexican Republic shall be deemed necessary to the just decision of any claim, the commissioners or the claimants through them shall, within such period as Congress shall designate, make an application in writing the same addressed to the Mexican Minister of Foreign Affairs, to be transmitted by the Secretary of State of the United States, and the Mexican government engages at the earliest possible moment after the receipt of such demand to cause any of the books, records, or documents so specified, which shall be in their possession or power, or the authenticated copies or extracts of the same, to be transmitted to the Secretary of State, who shall immediately deliver over to the said Board of Commissioners, provided that no application shall be made, or in the instance of any claimant, until the facts which shall be expected to prove by such books, records, or documents shall have been stated under oath or affirmation. It's kind of interesting. I said this before. America was in a position to continue going down to Central America. In other words, we had basically conquered all of the land going down to Mexico City. And America has basically, by this point in time, had become a pretty powerful nation. And it's not that we were seeking to become a dominant world power. At this point in time, we just wanted to be able to have our land and be able to develop as a nation, without the interference and intermingling of other nations. So again, we could have easily basically annexed Mexico at this point, because we already had the superiority. We had proven the superiority as we've basically pushed them all the way back. So when you look at what we're doing right here in basically giving and acceding to their lands and their demands within the area we're giving them, it just seems like, wow, there's not a lot of history where you find nations that only take what's theirs and go bend over backwards to make that happen. And so easily, and as a matter of fact, I'm not sure if, I think it was President Pope or Polk at the time. I think that there probably wasn't, you know, any difference in paradigms. I just think that the problem with the fact that this general, the armed forces leader of the United States in the area, went ahead and made this treaty just because of protocol, they had problems with it. But I honestly think it was kind of in line with the paradigm that America is not going to be a bully. We're not going to be, you know, harassed. We're not going to be bothered. You want to kick us? We're going to kick back. And so I find it really interesting how we really have gone down this path of bending over backwards to make things right so that we can have what we have and have the right to those things. Now, you got to remember also that there had been this, I'll just say, this mixture. Now, to be clear, Mexico did seek to come north, and they were trying to settle into these lands north. And even though prior to the United States Constitution, it was laid out by design and by claim that these independent colonies were going to stretch all the way over to the Pacific. At that point in time, Mexico probably started trying to vest more, and it's the infiltration of migration, right? When you get enough people there, it just becomes really hard for a nation to, you know, come in and say, hey, this land is ours. What are you doing here? The reason is that these people are innocent. It always, you know, there's a reason why evil, despotic nations and leaders always put hospitals around their military, their hard installations, their targets, hard targets. Because, you know, if you're going to blow up their airfield, then you're also going to hurt all these, you know, sick and inflicted and the lame and those people that are at the hospitals, the schools, children's schools. They deliberately do those things so that, oh, look how mean and how evil these warmongers are, because they blew up, you know, our children. They do that on purpose. Those are strategies to try to protect themselves. It's the same thing with migrations. And these concepts of migrations to, you know, to basically take a hold and control land, those things have been worked for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, if not a millennia, going all the way back to, as we look at the Crusades, with Islam, Christianity, and the Jews in basically who claiming the, you know, the Holy Land. Anyway, let me keep going. I want you to keep in mind, folks, that we could have had a full run. We get accused of being a colonizer. We get accused as a nation of being, you know, the world colonized. If any nation is guilty of colonization today, that is China. And nobody points their finger at China. Oh, well, this is how they change and take things out of context. They change the definitions, what really happened. They revise the truth so that it meets their narrative. But anyway, Article 16, each of the contracting parties reserved to itself the entire right to fortify whatever point within its territory it may judge so to fortify for its security. In other words, if we want to amass a lot of, you know, guns and fortifications along our border to protect ourselves from you, then you have a right to do that. Article 17, the Treaty of Amity Commerce and Navigation, concluded at the City of Mexico on the 5th day of April, A.D. 1831, between the United States and the United Mexican States. Now, interestingly enough, we're really looking at, you know, how many years later? How many years is this later? 17 years, something like that, 17 years later. So one of the things that we didn't do, and we may want to actually go back and read that treaty if you want to, you should read that, because I believe this is where we actually made these treaty agreements with Mexico that we were going to take these northern land and you're going to have the southern land. When Mexico was actually declaring its independence from Spain, this is when I believe this is where we already contributed to Santa Anna in fortifying him so that he could actually have their independence. And as a matter of fact, I think it's Kevin Gutzman, that wrote a book regarding the history and these treaties, how we ended up paying twice. We paid Mexico twice for the same land. So anyway, back to this. 1831, between the United States and the United Mexican States, accept the additional article and accept so far as the stipulations of that said of the said treaty may be incompatible with any stipulation contained in the present treaty, is hereby revived for the period of 8 years from the day of that exchange of ratifications of this treaty, with the same force and virtue as if incorporated therein, being understood that each of the contracting parties reserve to itself the right at any time after the said period of 8 years shall have expired, to terminate the same by giving 1 year's notice of such intention to the other party. Article 18. All supplies whatsoever for troops of the United States in Mexico arriving at the ports in the occupation of such troops previous to the final evacuation thereof, although subsequently to the restoration of the custom homes at such ports, shall be entirely exempt from duties and charges of any kind. The government of the United States hereby engaging and pledging its faith to establish and vigilantly to enforce all possible guards for securing the revenue of Mexico by preventing the importation under the cover of this stipulation of any articles other than such both in kind and quantity as shall really be wanted for the use and consumption of the forces of the United States during the time they may remain in Mexico. To this end, it shall be the duty of all officers and agents of the United States to denounce to the Mexican authorities at the respective ports any attempts at a fraudulent abuse of this stipulation, which they may know of or may have reason to suspect, and to give such authorities all the aid in their power with regard thereto, and every such attempt, when duly proved and established by the sentence of competent tribunal, they shall be punished with the confiscation of the property so attempted to be fraudulently introduced. Now, Article 19, with respect to all merchandise, effects, and property whatsoever imported into the ports of Mexico whilst the occupation of the forces of the United States, whether by citizens or either by republic or by citizens or subjects of any neutral nation, the following rules shall be observed. 1. All such merchandise affects property, if imported previously to the restoration of the custom houses to the Mexican authorities, as stipulated for in the third article of this treaty, shall be exempt from confiscation, although the importation of the same may be prohibited by the Mexican tariff. 2. The same perfect exemption shall be enjoyed by all merchandise, effects, and property imported subsequently to the restoration of the custom homes and previously to the 60 days fixed in the article for the coming into force of the Mexican tariff at such ports respectively, the said merchandise, effects, and property being, however, at the time of their importation, subject to the payment of duties and provided for in the said following article. 3. All merchandise, effects, and property described in the two rules foregoing shall, during their continuance at the place of importation and upon their leaving such place for the interior, be exempt from all duty, tax, or impost of every kind, under whatsoever title or denomination, nor shall they be there subject to any charge whatsoever upon the sale thereof. 4. All merchandise, effects, and property described in the first and second rules, which shall have been removed to any place in the interior whilst such place was in the occupation of the forces of the United States shall, during their continuance therein, be exempt all tax upon the sale of consumption thereof, and from the kind of impost or contributions under whatsoever title or denomination. Now, are you getting the drift that there may have been some shenanigans regarding the duties, taxes, imposts, and so forth that Mexico may have been applying? In other words, you know, you come into port and all of a sudden they want to up the tariffs and the duties to where, you know, the whole point of your shipping, because I wouldn't doubt that when you ship into a port with the expectations of these types of taxes, fees, imposts, what have you, I wouldn't doubt it that if all of a sudden it becomes a standard play that, oh, because it's coming from this country, we're going to assess these excessive imposts and so forth. So anyway, it just seems like, wow, they're really going into great detail of protecting commerce and the flow of goods coming in from these types of things. But if any merchandise affects a property, this is number five, but if any merchandise affects a property described in the first and second rule shall be removed to any place not occupied at the time by the forces of the United States, they shall, upon their introduction into such place or upon the sale or consumption there, be subject to the same duties which under the Mexican laws they would be required to pay in such cases if they have been imported in time of peace through the maritime custom houses and had their paid the duties conformably with the Mexican tariff. Interesting. The owners of such merchandise, effects, or property described in the first and second rules and existing ports in any port of Mexico shall have the right to reship the same exempt from all tax, impost, or contribution, whatever, with the respect to the metals or other property exported from any Mexican port whilst in the occupation of the forces of the United States and previously to the restoration of the custom house at such port, no person shall be required by the Mexican authorities, whether general or state, to pay any tax, duty, or contribution upon any such exportation or in any manner to account for the same to the said authorities. Article 20. Though consideration for the interest of commerce generally is agreed that if less than 60 days should elapse between the day of the signature of this treaty and the restoration of the custom houses conformably with the stipulation in the third article, in such case, all merchandise, effects, and property whatsoever arriving at the Mexican ports after the restoration of the said custom house and previously to the expiration of 60 days after the day of signature of this treaty shall be admitted to entry, and no other duty shall be levied thereon than the duties established by the tariff found in force at such custom houses at the time of the restoration of the same, and to all such merchandise, effects, and property, the rules established by the preceding article shall apply. Okay, so 21, and I find these things interesting because it just seems like, wow, there's all of this pandering towards the necessity of the Mexican government to put their hands in people's pockets. Now, it kind of reminds me of, you know, the days when when it was very common, you know, highway robbery being you're traveling with commerce. The next thing you know, these guys kind of show up at your doorstep, or they show up, you know, riding along with your cabin of goods or your wagon of goods. And they basically say, you know, hey, pull over and give us all your money, or, you know, pay us so that we can allow you to move forward. That's basically highway robbery. And so, when we come back, we'll get into Article 26 or 21, and we've got just three more articles to do, 21, 22, and then 23. So we'll be right back after this brief break. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so 21. If unhappy, any disagreement should hereafter arise between the governments of the two republics, whether with respect to the interpretation of any stipulation in this treaty, or with respect to any other particular concerning the political or commercial relations of the two nations, the said governments, in the name of those nations, do promise to each other that they will endeavor in the most sincere and earnest manner to settle the differences so arising and to preserve the state of peace and friendship in which the two countries are now placing themselves, using for this end mutual representation and pacific negotiations. And pacific negotiations. Maybe that meant to be specific. And if these means they should not be enabled to come to an agreement, a resort shall not, on this account, be had to reprisals, aggressions, or hostilities of any kind by the one republic against the other until the government of that which deems itself aggrieved shall have maturely considered in the spirit of peace and the good neighborship, whether it would be better that such differences should be settled by the arbitration of commissioners appointed on each side or by that friendly nation, and such course be proposed by either party, it shall be acceded to by the other unless deemed by it altogether incompatible with the nature of the difference or the circumstances of the case. I'll tell you what, this is a very laborious treaty. 22. If, which is not to be expected, and which, God forbid, war should unhappily break out between the two republics, they do now, with a view to such calamity, solemnly pledge themselves to each other and to the world to observe the following rules, absolutely where the nature and subject permits, and as closely as possible, in all cases where such absolute observance shall be impossible. 1. The merchants of either republic then residing in the other shall be allowed to remain 12 months for those dwelling in the interior and 6 months for those dwelling at the seaports to collect their debts and settle their affairs, during which periods they shall enjoy the same protection and be on the same footing in all respects as the citizens or subjects of the most friendly nations, and at the expiration thereof, or at any time before, they shall have full liberty to depart, carrying off all their effects without molestation or hindrance, conforming therein to the same laws which the citizens or subjects of the most friendly nations are required to conform to. Upon the entrance of the armies of either nation into the territories of other, women, children, ecclesiastics, scholars of every faculty, cultivators of the earth, merchants, artisans, manufacturers, and fishermen, unarmed and uninhabiting unfortified towns, villages, or places, and in general all persons whose occupations for the common subsistence and benefit of mankind shall be allowed to continue their respective employments, unmolested in their persons, nor shall their houses or goods be burnt or otherwise destroyed, nor their cattle taken, nor their fields wasted by the armed forces, into whose power by the events of war they may happen to fall. But if the necessity arise to take anything from them, to use of such armed force, that the same shall be paid for in an equitable price, all churches, hospitals, schools, colleges, libraries, and other establishments for charitable and beneficent purposes shall be respected, and all persons connected with the same protected in the discharge of their duties and the pursuit of their vocations. Wow. Now, one might think that both sides had a propensity, or, you know, tended to behave badly. You know, in other words, you know, burn, kill children and women and so forth, like marauders and so forth. Anyway, one would think that both sides were that way. Number two of Article 22, in order that the fate of prisoners of war may be alleviated, all such practices of those sending them to distant, inclement or unwholesome districts, or crowding them into close and noxious places, shall be studiously avoided. They shall not be confined in dungeons, prison ships, or prisons, nor be put in irons, or bound, or otherwise restrained in the use of their limbs. The officers shall enjoy liberty on their paroles within convenient districts, and have comfortable quarters, and the common soldiers shall be disposed in cantonments, and that's what it says, cantonments. And what does the heck cantonments mean? Do we have, no idea. In cantonments open and extensive enough for air and exercise, and lodged in barracks as roomy and as good as be provided by the party in whose power they are in for its own troops. But if any office shall break his parole by leaving the district so assigned, or any other prisoner shall escape for the limits of his cantonment after... Interesting, cantonment. I think that's an archaic term here. After they shall have been designated to him, such individual officers or other prisoners shall forfeit so much of the benefit of this article as provides for his liberty and parole, or in cantonment, and that's not containment. It's not, so it may be an old archaic word for containment. And if any officer so breaking his parole, and any common soldier so escaping from the limits assigned him, shall afterwards be found in arms previously to his being regularly exchanged, the person so offending shall be dealt with according to the established laws of war. The officer shall be daily furnished by the party in whose power they are with as many rations and of the same articles as are allowed either in any kind or commutation to officers of equal rank in its own army, and all others shall be daily furnished with rations as is allowed to a common soldier to its own service, the value of which supplies shall, at the close of the war, or periods to be agreed upon between the respective commanders, be paid by the other party, or a mutual adjustment of the accounts of the subsistence of prisoners, and such accounts shall not be mingled with or offset against any others, nor the balance of them on with the balance due on them withheld as a compensation of reprisal for any cause whatever, real or pretended. Now, I think it's interesting that they're talking about making sure that these prisoners are, you know, in a good state. They're being, you know, very civil, very, very civil. And folks, if you contrast the cultures of Britain and Spain and Portugal, if you look at the differences of how those two or three nations colonized the New World, you'll find that the brutality was very common within the Spanish and the Portuguese cultures, where they literally went through and they converted an existing race into a new race. I mean, the fact that the Mexicans, because you still have pure Spanish and you have Indians still, but not very many, because the Spaniards deliberately raped the women, the Indian women, and created Mexicans. That did not happen with the British forces to that degree, where we created, you know, this a nation of new a new nation of people genetically. And I'm going, so you can see why and how these things are being stipulated, because they want to make sure that if we are going to be in the same position, that they're going to treat us right. Because I believe all of these types of things come from the civil side of these negotiations. And I just find it interesting how we have these hard contrasts within these cultures. Anyway, each party shall be allowed to keep a commissary of prisoners appointed by itself, with every cantonment of prisoners in possession or of the other, which commissary shall be the prisoners as often he pleases, shall be allowed to receive, exempt from all duties and taxes, and to distribute whatever comforts may be sent to them by their friends, family, and so forth, and shall be free to transmit his reports in open letters to the party to whom he is employed. And it is declared that neither the pretense that war dissolves our treaty, all treaties, nor any other whatever, shall be considered as an annulling or suspending of the solemn covenant contained in this article. On the contrary, the state of war is precisely that for which it is provided, and during which its stipulations are to be sacredly observed as the most acknowledged obligations under the law of nature or nations. Finally, the 23rd article. This treaty shall be ratified by the President of the United States of America, and by, with the advice and consent of the Senate thereof, and by the President of the Mexican Republic, with the previous approbation of its General Congress. And the ratification shall be exchanged in the city of Washington, or at the seat of government of Mexico, in 4 months from the date of the signature hereof, or sooner if practicable, in faith whereof we, the respective plenipotentiaries, have signed this treaty of peace, friendship, limits, and settlement, and have hereunto affixed our seals respectively, done in quintuplet, in other words, instead of triplicate, you know, they did four copies, at the city of Guadalupe Hidalgo, on the second day of February, in the year of our Lord, 1848. So there you have it. There is the treaty, and I'm not sure precisely what the point of bringing this treaty in, how the United States government has done things. I don't understand what the state nationalist point is. They just refer to this treaty. And I go, huh, what I see is that because we had this, I'll just don't want to say humility, but because we had maybe the nobility or the presence and honor and to recognize and to treat Mexico, even though, you know, we had thoroughly defeated, beat them, that they be, you know, given the due respect as a nation, and I, you know, move forward with the best of footings. So, as we kind of look at the treaty itself, I just don't see anything there where, wow, that's a huge, you know, there it is. There's the red flag right there. Aha! This is where they basically violated the Constitution. Now, even though the treaty may have been managed outside of the president's guide and saying, these are the people that I choose to do that, even though at this point in time, to just help expedite things, the general took that leave, or basically took the license to do these things, It's not that he decided that they would ratify outside of the constitutional process. It still had to go back to the president and to the U.S. Senate, and they may not have been happy with the fact that he just jumped to the conclusion to do it. I don't think they had any problems with it, other than maybe there was a desire in D.C. to keep more of the Mexican land instead of surrendering all of that land back. Folks, go look at where Mexico City is. This is how far down the United States was. The problem is, and I think the smart thing was, we wanted to maintain our land. Why assume land that would be nothing but problematic? In other words, the majority of all the inhabitants do not speak English. The majority of all the inhabitants in this part of Mexico would just basically be considered, I'll just say, enemies. Because they're not going to be friendly. They aren't going to be happy with the fact that they're no longer citizens of Mexico. And that they're, you know, their property or what have you. And it just, going back to where it should be was just the right thing to do. And most nations never do that. Look at Crimea. Look what's going on in Ukraine. Look at Hong Kong. Look at what China has been doing around the world. It's all about, it's ours, it's ours. Look at Taiwan. These nations are basically colonizational nations. These nations are tyrannical. They don't care about actually allowing people the opportunity of self-governance. No, we will govern you. That's their paradigm. If you contrast the United States paradigm of liberty and self-governance, which is what we're supposed to have, then it is a night and day difference. Now, as we look at all of the different enabling acts, because we actually have a few different enabling acts, and what I want to do is I actually want to bring in the Vermont Enabling Act. And the reason I want to bring in the Vermont Enabling Act before I read the Utah Enabling Act is to give you a good comparison as to what the Enabling Act should constitutionally state. Because we've gone through what we call the equal footing doctrine of the Constitutional Convention. Remember, during the Constitutional Convention, most of the delegates there wanted to subjugate these new states joining the Union. They said, no. We can't do that. Everybody comes in with equal footing. They're all going to have their own sovereignty. They're going to own their own land. They're going to be equal parties in this compact. There will be no diminishment of their sovereignty. Okay, so this is what the Enabling Act for Vermont was, and it was done in Philadelphia. And let me see, what was the year? 1791. Congress of the United States at the third session begun and held at the city of Philadelphia on Monday, the 6th December, 1790. An act for the admission of the state of Vermont into this union. The state of Vermont having petitioned the Congress to be admitted a member of the United States, be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, and it is hereby enacted and declared that on the fourth day of March 1791, the said state by name and style of, quote, the State of Vermont, close quote, shall be received and admitted into this union as a new and entire member of the United States of America. This was done by the Speaker of the House, John Adams, the Vice President, Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, who was the Speaker of the House, John Adams, the Vice President, and approved on the 18th, 1791, by George Washington, the President of the United States. Deposited among the rolls in the office of the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State. Now, here's an interesting thing. When we look at the naming convention the state of Vermont. Now, when we look at the Constitution of Washington State, not the state of Washington, which is it supposed to be? Now, back in these days, they were actually saying the state of. And as we look at how things have kind of migrated under the corporations and so forth, that language kind of gets specific. But nevertheless, let's dive into Utah. Now, this is the act, enabling act for Utah. An act to enable the people of Utah to form a constitution and state government and to be admitted into the union on equal footing with the original states. Now, that's all they needed to say. However, all of these caveats actually defy that line. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the inhabitants of all that part of the area of the United States now constituting the territory of Utah, as at present described, may become the state of Utah, as hereinafter provided. Section 2. That all male citizens of the United States over the age of 21 years who have resided in the said territory for 1 year next prior to such election are hereby authorized to vote and choose delegates to form a convention in said territory. Such delegates shall possess the qualifications of such electors, and the aforesaid convention shall consist of 107 delegates apportioned among the several counties within the limits of the proposed state as follows. Now, so who are these people? Are these just people? No, these are delegates that are going to represent their county. So they're doing this consistently still to this day. They're still doing this consistently. Now, Beaver County, 2 delegates. Box Elder County, 4 delegates. Cache County, 8 delegates. Davis County, 3 delegates. Emory County, 3 delegates. And on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And so Uinta County, 1 delegate. Let me get to the last one. Weber County, 11 delegates. And the governor of said territory shall, on this first day of August, 1894, issue a proclamation ordering an election of the delegates of the aforesaid in said territory to be held on the Tuesday next after the first Monday in November following the Board of Commissioners known as the Utah Commission is hereby authorized and required to cause a new and complete registration of voters of said territory to be made under the provisions of the laws of the United States and said territory, except that the oath required for registration under said laws shall be so modified as to test the qualification of the electors as prescribed in this act. Such new registration shall be made nearly conformable to the provisions of such laws as may be, and such elections for delegates shall be conducted, the returns made, the result ascertained, and the certificate of persons elected to such convention, issued in the same manner as is prescribed by the laws of the said territory regulating elections therein, of members of the legislature, persons possessing the qualifications entitling them to vote for delegates under this act shall be entitled to vote on the ratification or rejection of the Constitution under such rules or regulations as said convention may prescribe, not in conflict with this act. Now, I got a lot of problems with what they kind of threw in here. The fact is that the federal government cannot actually dictate some of these things. It's one thing to take the consensus and say, you're going to choose this many. You're going to go into a convention or city and maybe even decide what city that would be. Salt Lake or what have you in this particular case, but maybe dictate those things. But when it comes down to dictating outcomes, dictating these other things, qualifications and so forth, that should really be left to the state. Now, granted, in the admission of states into the union, while the territory is being prepared, Congress has the power to make needful rules and regulations of that territory. But in its transition into becoming a state, the state itself, the people itself, are to have their own self-determination of what and how to do these things with a little bit of guide and help from the federal government. Not rules and regulations and constrainment, but guide and help. Okay. Section 3, that the delegates to the convention thus elected shall meet at the seat of government of said territory on the first Monday in March, 1895, and after organization shall declare on behalf of the people of the of said proposed state that they adopt the Constitution of the United States, whereupon the said convention shall be and is hereby authorized to form a constitution and state for the said proposed state. The Constitution shall be Republican in form and make no distinction in civil or political rights on account of race, color, except as Indians not taxed. And I find it interesting that this far past this, you could tell that they've done everything they can to backpedal the 14th Amendment and making Indians citizens. The fact that the 14th Amendment made all people under the jurisdiction of the federal government within the United States citizens. And you can see that they're continually playing these games with the Indians. And to not be repugnant to the Constitution of the United States and the principles of the Declaration of Independence, and said convention shall provide by ordinance with irrevocable, shall provide by ordinance irrevocable without the consent of the United States and the people of the said state. First, that perfect toleration of religious sentiment shall be secured, and that no inhabitant of said state shall ever be molested in person or property on account of his or her religious worship, that polygamous or plural marriages are forever prohibited. Now, I find it interesting that they're making a law respecting religion. I understand the hate. I understand the disdain that Mormons have had. But the fact is, the federal government cannot make laws like this. They cannot create rules and regulations respecting these things, especially regarding a state and its own self-determination. Second, that the people inhabiting said proposed state do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof. Well, hold on here. There's no such thing as public lands within the United States Constitution. A state is a state, and a state actually has, you know, these boundaries, and everything within that boundary is under the sovereignty and the declaration and control of the state government. Now, recognizing property, individual property rights and so forth, anything that doesn't have claims, well, you know what? We're going to come back tomorrow. Or actually, we'll come back on Friday, because tomorrow we're getting into content. We'll be doing the ratification debates. But we'll come back and we'll revisit the second paragraph or the second stipulation here and keep going. We're going to pick this apart, folks, so you can actually see how far the federal government had wandered outside its bounds. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.